You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Slate's Audio Book Club. I'm Jacob Weisberg, chairman of the Slate Group, and I'm joined today by Troy Patterson, Slate's TV critic, and Jody Rosen, who's Slate's music critic. Today we're going to talk about Super Sad True Love Story, a new novel by Gary Steingart. And just to get our conversation started today, Troy, let me ask you to tell us what the story of this book is.
Well, the book is set in an unspecified but very near future, many of the features of which may have already come to pass by the time this discussion gets posted on the site. The United States is laboring under a crushing debt, and the dollar is pegged to the yuan. People have, rather than smartphones, these sort of viciously cunning ones called apparats. Yeah, there are umlauts on all those A's. Is that how I want to pronounce it? And these project this endless stream of images and data. And moreover, they talk back to the universe, and that every street corner in Manhattan is features a credit poll that'll read and broadcast your credit rating. Moreover, there's a setting, if you change the community parameters, and you're, you know, a young man on the make in a bar, it'll broadcast your personality ranking and your fuckability rating. And young women who, you know, hear people in their teens and 20s have sort of no sense of history, and women are taken to, you know, dressing in a brand of jeans called onion skins, which are transparent, and I think the most popular make of panties is called Total Surrender, which turn off with a push of a button, come off with a push of the button. So this is to say that the book is something of a science fiction novel, and as our hero, Lenny Abramoff, writes to his diary at one point, the true subject of science fiction is death, not life. It will all end. Lenny is employed in post-human services, at a business that promises to extend the life of high-net-worth individuals, perhaps indefinitely. Lenny says in the first line of the book that he's decided that he's never going to die, and his strategy for that involves both becoming a customer of post-human services, and he also intends to be sustained by the love of one Eunice Park, a Korean woman who he meets in a bravura opening passage set in Rome and eventually cohabitates with in New York City.
The book is the story of their relationship, them falling in love, and then what happens to their romance under the conditions of this strange, oppressive society. Right. But Jody, what kind of book is this? I mean, Troy just used a whole bunch of different terms. Science fiction. Sounded in part like a very dark comedy. Sounded like a social satire. It's a romance, too. I mean, what's it like reading this book, and what's the writing like?
Well, the writing is alternately hyper-caffeinated and intensely lyrical and, you know, funny even, you know, at the same time. I mean, it's often all three things at once. Steingrad, I think, is a really masterful stylist, but, you know, it's a very fun book to read, despite the fact that it's an incredibly disturbing vision of the near future or the present, depending on how you look at it. I mean, I guess it's a dystopian novel if you want to get I'm sure that's what all our literature professors would tell us.
Well, stop for a second. Yeah. That term, I think, has been thrown about in every review I've read of the book. What is a dystopian novel?
A dystopian novel. You want me to give a chapter? Yeah. a dystopian novel is a bleak vision of the future. I mean, can anyone help me with anything that's any more specific than that?
Is a dystopian novel one that sort of speaks to the sorrows and miseries of contemporary society by exaggerating their features?
I think that's a pretty good definition. I mean, I guess technically the definition is it's a reversal of a utopian story, you know, as opposed to imagining a paradise. It imagines a paradise turned into a kind of hell. And, you know, the most famous dystopian novels, Brave New World, 1984, which is, you know, clearly the touchstone for this book. I mean, 1984 is the story of Winston and Julia, these two humans caught up in this totalitarian society where people are spied on throughout their life, and this a story of how this repression makes their love impossible and crushes it. And that's the kind of dystopian novel I felt this was.
I think I would add that to be a dystopian novel, it's not enough to just imagine a bleak future. I think that it's essential that the protagonist is alienated from society, that sort of communities and relationships become difficult, if not impossible, to sustain. And that's true here, that loneliness and aloneness are words that keep coming up.
So expand on that a little, Troy. Why does this character, Lenny, not fit into this society?
Well, for one thing, he's a 20th century man in this 21st century that has sort of no respect for literature, for one thing. Lenny makes a lot of the fact that he has this wall of books in his apartment. And books are largely shunned in the society. People find them smelly. And as it goes along, he finds reason to chat about Chekhov and about Milan Kundera. And a lot of the most lyrical and beautiful scenes are sort of elegiac and nostalgic, which can be tricky in books, but I think that part of the power of the prose comes from it's very much an earned nostalgia, and it's not sort of sappy. It's brave.
Yeah, I think it's especially effective because of the sort of intensity of the satire that surrounds it, and the fact that the book is so absurd and broadly comic for the most part, that when he shifts his cadence into a more lyrical mode, when he starts writing, as Troy says, in this elegiac way, it's really powerful and it doesn't come off as zappy. And again, and I think Troy's right that the lyricism is earned because he's set up this both sort of blackly comic and terrifying world so effectively.
Do you have an example, Jody, of his lyricism? You were mentioning beginning a passage that stood out for you.
There's a passage I really liked on page 96. This is when Lenny is returning to Manhattan on the Staten Island ferry after visiting his friends in the hipster mecca of St. George, Staten Island. I mean, one of the things that really stood out for me about this book, and I'd love to talk about, is it seems to me that it's archetypally New York novel, a great New York novel, which has a lot to say about New York City, past, present, and future. And so in this upside-down world, Lenny lives out in Manhattan. And, you know, all his friends are in Staten Island. Anyway, he's returning after an evening with his friends on Staten Island, and he writes, and Steingart writes, The rankings of other passengers swept across the bow, the ugly ruined men emoting their desire and despair over the rail and into the dark, relentless waves. A pink mist hovered over the mostly residential area once known as the Financial District, casting everything in the past tense. A father kept kissing his tiny son's head over and over with a sad insistence, making those of us with bad parents or no parents feel even more lonely and alone. We watched the silhouettes of oil tankers, guessing at the warmth of their holds. The city approached. The three bridges connecting Brooklyn and Manhattan, one long necklace of light, gradually differentiated themselves. The Empire State extinguished its crown and tucked itself away behind a lesser building. On the Brooklyn side, the gold-tipped Williamsburg Savings Bank, cornered by the half-built abandoned glass giants around it, quietly gave us the finger. Only the bankrupt Freedom Tower, empty and stern in profile, like an angry man risen and ready to punch, celebrated itself throughout the night. Every returning New Yorker asks the question, is this still my city? I have a ready answer cloaked in obstinate despair. It is. And if it's not, I will love it all the more. I will love it to the point where it becomes mine again.
That's wonderful. I mean, there is one of the things I thought was incredible about this book was this sort of immigrant love song to New York City in the middle, buried in the middle of this dystopian vision of New York gone to absolute hell, you know, which that passage captures, just the beauty of the city that's still there.
Yeah, that's one of the things about, I mean, as you say, buried in this book. I mean, there are two immigrant stories being told here, because Eunice Park, Lenny's girlfriend, is a Korean immigrant, and Lenny is this Russian-Jewish, son of Russian-Jewish immigrants, or rather Eunice's parents are Korean-American immigrants. And so this is a really sort of a black absurdist take on a classic New York novel genre, that is the kind of bootstrapping immigrant makes good in the big city. Here that vision goes terribly wrong.
And you get this fantastic lyricism, fantastic comedy around sex and food, which are both very much in the immigrant context. Did you note any of that, Troy? Those great eating scenes.
They're great eating scenes. For one thing, it cast me back to Stuttgart's first novel, Russian Debutante's Handbook, which begins with an amazing description of a soppressata sandwich, the sort of the rapture of this meat. Yeah, it's both of those facets of the book point towards the way it's sort of a book about comfort and Lenny's yearning to be nurtured. It was only on looking at the book a second time, and you tell me if you think I'm reaching too much or if this is cheesy, I noticed that, Eunice Park, a standard Korean last name, there is also something kind of idyllic, and there's a quality of an oasis in what Lenny is seeking from her.
That he wouldn't have gotten if he called her Eunice Kim.
Yeah. And I do think it's important that there's another one of those sort of beautiful, tender scenes set in Central Park, which is where they share an important kiss. And meanwhile, I think we've forgotten to mention that the United States is bogged down in sort of a vaguely specified conflict in Venezuela. And a lot of veterans who haven't gotten their pay are camped out in Tompkins Square Park, where Eunice does some volunteering. So these are two images of parks, downtown and Tompkins Square Park, people making this sort of rude shelter and trying to survive, and Central Park sort of hanging on as this sort of paradise amid concrete and guns.
Yeah. But of course, later in the novel, both parks become scenes of combat where American National Guard soldiers, who we later find are really in the employ of the multinational corporation for which Lenny works, open fire on American citizens, on the poor and disaffected veterans and other ethnic New Yorkers. So,
and what is the political regime? I mean, it's a little foggy, but it sort of seems that America is still basically some sort of democracy, but there's a shadowy president who's like Donald Rumsfeld. And there's this right-wing media, which is you have your choice between Fox News Prime or Fox.
I think it's Fox News, Liberty Prime Fox Liberty, and right. Fox Liberty Ultra.
Liberty Ultra. Yeah. No. There's. If I remember correctly, there's kind of a puppet president called Joe Cortez. Is that right? And then there's a kind of Rumsfeldian Secretary of Defense figure named Rubenstein. Yeah. I don't think we ever get his first name. But I think it's important that he's Jewish, given the fact that Lenny Abramoff is, and there's, you know, this is a very Jewish book.
Yeah.
And also, are we certain that it's a democracy? Because all the indications are that there's sort of one party called nicely the bipartisan party.
Right.
Go ahead.
It's not exactly a democracy. It's sort of a you know, the funny thing about actually the political vision in this book, I think, is that it's not, even though, you know, the targets that we've talked about, the satirical targets we've talked about thus far, the Rumsfeldian Secretary of Defense, the Fox News, all these right-wing media outlets, those seem like sort of typical left-wing targets. Steingart is really an equal opportunity satirist across the political spectrum. For instance, the company for which he works, his job is to, he tries to find high net worth individuals who he can target for selling a kind of sham life extension regime, everyone that works at the company are sort of young bourgeois bohemian go getters whose diet is a, you know, I guess that you would say, like,
they're
a
starving
hyper,
themselves
hyper
to death on organic food,
hyper macrobiotic diet. So his targets are left wing Bobos as well as right wing.
Do we think that they're still a left wing? Because the feeling I get is that the average citizen is sort of been beaten into this apathy or is resigned to the domination of the bipartisan party. So there are still these college students and these former soldiers who will wage protest, but
most people are stupefied by social media and shopping and entertainment. I mean, actually, what I took to be, I think this is a very interesting kind of political take, as opposed to the classic dystopian novel of totalitarianism, where the all-powerful state is watching you all the time and people are spying on each other and their freedom has been taken away by the government. Here, people have given up their freedom through their entrancement with media devices. They carry this, as you were saying, Troy, at the beginning, these apparats, which constantly connect them and give them all information about each other. So you can immediately find out everyone's credit score, their sexual attractiveness, and how healthy they are, whether they're good prospects. So people have kind of voluntarily participated in the system where they've given up all privacy and everything is a kind of commodity. But there's no it seems to me in that vision, the state hasn't taken that away. People have fallen into this.
You know, I was looking over this book this morning in the coffee shop where I spend all my time, and the acquaintance sitting next to me had a quick grouse about FaceTime, which was this iPhone feature that I wasn't even aware existed, where you know, it's 8 o'clock in the morning and the person you're speaking to is looking at you. That is, I hope, a relevant aside.
Well, you know, I had Jody mentioned this at the outset, but I had, for me, the basic experience of reading this book was thinking, Gary Steingart, what a great absurdist satirist he is, what a dark vision of the future, and then looking around and realizing he was describing something that already exists in very close to the form he was talking about it.
Yeah, you know, I guess the my reservations about the book, I kept wanting to I found myself wanting to take issue with the vision. That is to say, I wanted to find Steingart's satire too broad, and there were occasions that I did. For instance, the society's hypersexualized to the point where kindergartners watch pornography. Like there's a passage where I think We should say that the character Eunice Park, the book is structured as diary entries by Lenny Abramoff, interspersed with email exchanges,
right,
and chat and you know, text message or chat exchanges between Eunice Park and her sister and her friends.
And in that sense, it's structured as a epistolary novel, so called,
right,
where it's based on the letters written by various people. But sorry, go on.
Right. But in any case, I think in one of the exchanges, email exchanges, or actually there. I should say global teen exchanges. The entire internet, I think, is now called something – is called global teens, or everybody – the only way people communicate is through a network or an interface called global teens.
Which is Facebook,
which
projected
is, right,
5 years into the future.
Right.
Right. Maybe 50 years.
But Eunice Park and her friend are recalling, you know, their favorite Vietnamese porn star from their kindergarten years, and that sort of, you know, that sort of stuff. Okay, it's funny, but it seemed a little cheap to me, and there was a lot of stuff like that. I found the part of the book that irked me a bit was Steingart's vision of sort of sexual mores, and his which struck me as somewhere between. I felt like we were getting an unmediated glimpse of the author's psyche that made me a little uncomfortable,
yeah,
as opposed to some kind of, you know, sharp indictment of, you know, a hyper-pornographied contemporary culture.
Right. Well, two things. I think, one, in some Don DeLillo book, there's sort of a bit of satire that I never found successful, where a character is talking about child pornography and making clear it's not pornography with children, it's pornography for children. And that seemed to me a bit – that's not what human nature is like. Also, you know, I have a friend who's a fan of Steingart and a very good reader, but who also, having lived in China for 3 years, is ready to discount the book because of its vision of the sort of the rise of the supremacy of China, which is sort of, you know, this idea that floats around sort of easily and alarmistly, you know, when in fact – you know, this book isn't set that far in the future, and I mean, you've been to China, Jacob. It's not a first-rate country.
Well, but the book, it's funny. I mean, your friend knows a lot about China, but I don't think this book has anything to say about China. It has something to say about the relative economic power of the United States in China, and all the book projects is at some point in the future where China's economy is much bigger than ours. We have such debt to China that they have a lot of power over us, and the yuan has replaced the dollar as the currency that has kind of permanent value. I don't know. I found all of that, you know, yes, no, it's not 5 years away, but, you know, 50 years away is, you know, is will China be a bigger economy than the U.S.? Probably.
I guess since we're talking about gripes about the book, this kind of picture of a post-literate age, and, you know, where
right, people have sort of lost the ability to read and to talk,
right,
in this book.
Yeah, in fact, talking is referred to as verballing.
Verballing, and college students do much less reading than scanning.
Yeah. Right, and you know, people are constantly streaming. Sort of live streaming their lives. I think the kind of equivalent of blogs are these little, as they're called, media shows. These broadcasts that people do over the apparats. So, for instance, two of Lenny's friends have these kind of shows where they have, you know, tens of thousands of people who follow their stream, and they live broadcast from the bar where they happen to be drinking. But you know, I mean, one thing about the internet is it. I don't think that the internet necessarily portends the end of literacy. It might portend the end of print media. And so, I mean, not that that's, you know, a major flaw with the book. And it's, you know, if you go through a novel like this ticking off, okay, here it seems like, you know, he might be onto something, here he's not. That's it seems to me a sort of silly way to read a book like this. However, those things irked me a little bit, and I felt like they sort of detracted from some of the impact.
Don't you worry? I think I disagree with you a little bit there, Jody, because I mean, don't you worry that people are losing or will lose the ability to read books basically because of what happens to their attention span in a totally connected, media-saturated environment?
Yeah, I guess, but also, I mean, I feel like there's a lot of the vision of the kind of internet age, and I guess you'd call in this book sort of post internet age or internet 5.0, there's no beauty there. Among other things that the internet has awakened is incredible interest in history. You know, communities of people that form around fascinating arcane interests. You know, which are actually hyper literate. You know, the fact that I guess we could just leave it there. To me, it didn't. It didn't especially work for me. There's a bunch of things that sort of landed with a thud for me and didn't ring true. And I think it goes back to what Troy said about human nature. You know, I understand for the purposes of a absurdist novel why Steingart would go there, but I didn't. They didn't especially resonate for me. Another thing is the love affair between Lenny and Eunice. I think was sort of flawed. How instantly Lenny, this woman became Lenny's, you know, muse and lodestar. Troy talked about that, the scene where they met in Rome as a kind of bravura scene, and I think they meet at a kind of orgy sex party at the home of Lenny's then lover, who's a kind of older hairy swarthy Roman woman. That's what we learn about her. But Lenny sees this cute Korean girl, talks to her for 5 minutes, they have a night out, they have bad ham-fisted sex, and then all of a sudden she's it. And I've read many novels that I think were more successful in conveying sort of love at first sight than this one. So
that's interesting. I think I agree with that somewhat, that in that the way he fixates on women, first with the prior girlfriend from the party, and then this woman he sees across the room and falls in love with, doesn't seem to have that much to do with her. It has a lot to do with him and his fantasy of romantic relationship, which he slots this woman into, you know, against her reluctance, at least, and ultimately unsuccessfully.
A successful thing about the book, I would say, is that Steingart is really subtle in his depiction of Lenny.
Yeah.
He's not a particularly appealing character, and when you come to the end of the book, you realize the various ways in which he's treated people badly, unwittingly killed his friend, and presumably dozens of other people on the Staten Island ferry. So I don't know.
Right. I don't know. I sign on with Jacob's view of the relationship, and I think that that's what sells it, because we understand that that Lenny has a special weakness for Korean women that will sort of blind him to some of Eunice's less attractive aspects. And it's also clear early on that there's sort of a desperation in his attachment to her, that he's looking to her as this kind of fountain of youth. And so, you know, despite whatever is genuine and tender in his feeling for her, there's also sort of a sense of hollowness, which isn't, I think, very present in the first half of the book. But as things go on and their sort of the intensity of this romance recedes, it feels perfectly natural that that things should fall apart in the way that they do.
Yeah. I want to get back just before we finish to this sort of idea of technology in the book, because I think we might have left a little bit of what seemed to me to be a false impression, which is that the book is anti-technology, that it's some kind of argument that all of this is leading to the inability of people to read, and he hates it. It seemed to me that the book also expresses this kind of delight in technology, and that it's part of the subtlety of it is showing you the sort of science fiction miraculous part. Imagine what we'll be able to do with these things in the future, but also look at what may happen to us if we do. Did you have the same takeaway about it that I did?
You're stumping me, so I'm going to meditate on that.
I guess I was thinking about it a little bit, in relation to 1984 again, because one of the interesting things about 1984, as I remember it, is it's based very much on
English socialism after the Second World War. You know, the organization is called INGSOC. But Orwell, of course, was a Labour Party supporter of English socialism. And it wasn't – the book wasn't written to say we're going down a, you know, a path of no return and this is not what society should be doing. He was sort of taking some of the premises of his own politics and things that he supported and projecting them into a negative dimension in the future. And I guess I because the book is in, so closely modeled on 1984 in a lot of ways, I felt that Steingart really was doing the same thing. He wasn't necessarily trying to say, don't go there. He was sort of saying, imagine the worst that could happen based on where we're going.
I'll buy that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm buying it. I don't know. I like this book very much. Tell me if I'm being picky when I wonder if it doesn't quite get the momentum that I want from it because of how it works as an epistolary book, an epistolary novel. We're alternating between these richly written, wonderful scenes of, you know, Lenny confiding to his diary, and then in a different typeface, these records of Eunice's emails and instant messages, which are necessarily kind of semi-literate. And I wonder if they, for one thing, I wonder if they slow things down a bit and make the book more episodic than they might be. I suppose, on the other hand, they're necessary to moving things forward, but I wonder if they move things forward a bit more choppily.
Yeah, I mean, those Eunice's emails and such felt to me like they were, you know, I felt the cogs turning a little bit there. I mean, they felt like they were important structurally as like a device to convey what she's thinking and to contrast it with Lenny's myopic vision of their romance and the world, and also to give, you know, in those emails, there's a lot of funny slang, and you get to see how, you know, a 25-year-old woman communicates with her contemporaries in this society, which is, you know, there's a lot of, God, what are the crazy sort of internet acronyms bandied about. So, I mean, they were funny, but I agree with you. I think this book could have worked just as well if it was only a first-person novel told in Lenny's voice. I don't know. The passages, I mean, the sections in which Lenny's writing his diary are so great because for me, it's not just the kind of you know, the satire with this dystopia that really struck me. It was the really in passing, all kinds of wisdom and insight that Steingart gets off. I'm thinking there's a passage on page 14. He's talking, he's in Italy at this point. He says, "That's what I admire about youngish Italians, the slow diminution of ambition, the recognition that the best is far behind them. We Americans can learn a lot from their graceful decline." Or another passage on page 84, he's talking about his relationship with his two male friends, Vishnu and Noah. And Steingart writes, "We all grew up with a fairly tense idea of male friendship for which the permissive times now allowed us to compensate, and I often wished that our crude words and endless posturing were code for affection and understanding. In some male societies, slang and ritualistic embraces form the entire culture along with the occasional call to take up the spear." And it's just it's moments like that, I think, that are, you know, where Steingart is, you know, revealed. I mean, Steingart is just an incredibly smart, wise, sensitive human being, and he just gets at a lot of truth about human nature.
Judy, I love Steingart's writing. I've read all three of his books, and this is my favorite of them. But this has been greeted really in a different way from the others. I mean, this has been treated, I think, probably along with Jonathan Franzen's Freedom as the kind of important book of the season, or one of the really important books of the year. As a final question for you both, do you think this book has the makings of a classic? That is, I would define it as, do you think people will be reading and talking about this book in 20 years?
I think so, yeah. You know, one of my beliefs as a reader, that what really sets apart first-rate prose is the control of light, instead of writing about daylight or room light. To which end, I want to read a passage that Jody and I were talking about as we were settling in. Lenny's talking about his friend Noah. Noah told me there's a day during summer when the sun hits the broad avenues at such an angle that you experience the sensation of the whole city being flooded by a melancholy 20th century light, even the most prosaic, unloved buildings appearing bright and nuclear at the edge of your vision, and that when this happens, you want to both cry for something lost and run out there and welcome the decline of the day. He made it sound like an urban rapture, his aging face taking on a careful glow as if he was borrowing some of the light of which he spoke. Yeah, I like that very much. I think that there's something Nabokovian in the way that he controls that sense of light, and also in sort of the elegiac quality of the book, his way of writing about memory and the past in a way that's very sensitive and evocative, but honest. And in fact, in thinking about that, I was led to pick up Nabokov's Speak Memory to look for the exact phrasing of one particular line that came to mind at a few points in this book, which is, "The cradle rocks above an abyss, and common sense tells us that our existence is but a brief crack of light between two eternities of darkness." And I think that the mood evoked there is what's going on at the best parts of this book, and that's where why it's going to be durable.
Yeah, I agree with Troy completely, and the book did have a Nabokovian quality for me as well. And you know, Nabokov is my godhead, just like he's everyone else's. And you know, Steingart really does have a great command of writing about, you know, landscape and consciousness, and that is, you know, I mean, there's a part of me that resists these kinds of novels that are broad social satires, because to me it strikes me at some level as cheap, or as, even when it's a virtuoso display of it, as in Steingart, but this novel had so much more happening in it as well. And I just want to return for 1 minute to the New York theme in it. You know, like a couple of the passages we've read have this kind of nostalgia for the lost New York, which of course is the quality. That's a feeling that every New Yorker has for all time, because we live in a city that's you know, constantly mutating. And also, I the way in which I thought this novel really speaks to this moment beyond its, you know, vision of social media gone nuts and whatever the political landscape is, like, you know, it's a novel about gentrification and a changing city, and you know, that's one of many reasons that I think it will be around 20 years from now.
And Nabokov is a great point of comparison, because like Nabokov, Steingart, I believe, is not a native English speaker. He came to America from Russia as a child and was not fluent in English. And there's an exuberance to his language and a glee and a joy in what he does with English that I think at the end is what marks out his writing as extraordinary and, as Jody says, takes it beyond what might be a little bit easy about doing a straight sort of social satire. And as the host, I think I'll make that the last word, but I really want to thank Troy Patterson, Jody Rosen, for joining me today to talk about Super Sad True Love Story. For Slate's Audiobook Club, I'm Jacob Weisberg.